All right, everyone, we might make a start. Certainly I found today very thought-provoking, and this session proves to be very thought-provoking too. So I've been brought in very last minute to chair the session. So Tyler, please bear with me. I hope I do an okay job for us all. I'm going to introduce our speaker today. Tyler's a postdoctoral research fellow at the School of Public Health and Preventative Medicine. He tells me he's American, not Canadian. I don't know what that means exactly. I've got nothing against Canadians or Americans, but Tyler might share. He's been here in Australia for 2.5 years. Prior to that, he was with the UK Ministry of Justice. So, Tyler, you're going to have some really interesting and different perspectives on the topic today, which is about return to work outcomes. He's passionate about improving those, and I'm looking forward to hearing from him on behalf of the panel that prepared the paper that sits behind it today. There's a bunch of fantastic credentials here for Tyler, but I think we'll let his presentation talk to that because I look really old with my reading glasses on. Look, he holds a philosopher's degree in evidence-based intervention from the University of Oxford, and therein is the link with us actuaries and our numerical approach to stuff. So without further ado, Tyler, I'll get you up here to speak. He's happy to take questions as he goes.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Jefferson, and thank you for attending. So today I'm going to be talking about a study that I've done recently looking at the impact of return-to-work coordinators on return-to-work outcomes. I'd just like to acknowledge all of my co-authors on this paper. This is a peer-reviewed paper at the Journal of Occupational Rehabilitation, and that's Rebecca Lilly, Sheila Hogg-Johnson, Tony LaMontagna, Malcolm Sim, and Peter Smith. And we'll start with a little bit of a background about who return-to-work coordinators are. You can find them around the world. They sometimes go under different names like rehabilitation coordinator, but they all have the same general role, and that's to work with the injured worker and other stakeholders in the return-to-work process to manage the injured worker to get them back on the job. Some of the things they do are coordinate with the healthcare provider to understand what the injured worker can do, what their limitations are, finding out from the employer what jobs are available, and then planning return to work based on that. They can be based in a number of places, not just at the workplace, but at the hospital, government agency, or even an independent consultant. And there is a bit of evidence to suggest that interventions that have a coordinator improve return-to-work outcomes, but for the most part, they don't differentiate between a coordinator and other components of those interventions. So it's impossible to tell whether or not it's the coordinator themselves that are improving these outcomes, or if it's just something else in these packages. There is one exception. That's a paper from Singapore last year, and that found that in a randomized controlled trial, hospital-based return-to-work coordinators did actually improve return-to-work outcomes. When you ask coordinators themselves what they think makes a coordinator successful in the role, they often list two broad characteristics or skills, and that's managerial skills and interpersonal skills. In Victoria specifically, where we conducted this study, coordinators are required by all employers under the WorkSafe scheme. Depending on the organization size, you may need them at all points, and that's over $2 million remuneration in 2013 dollars. That's gone up a few since that time. If you're under that amount, it's only for the period of the return-to-work obligation, so pretty much from the moment of injury to achieving return-to-work. They are all employer-based in Victoria. This means that they are selected from among the organization. They are not someone who's brought outside in to work on the return-to-work. And their primary responsibility... And they're selected within this, the organization for two characteristics, and that's competency in return to work and also seniority within the organization to be able to speak on behalf of the employer. And their main role is to assist the employer to meet their return to work obligations, and among these is the planning for return to work. And planning for return to work, that obligation begins the moment the employer either receives a certificate of capacity or they receive a claim for weekly payments or they're informed that their agent has received these. In Victoria, coordinators are offered a two-day training. It's not mandatory, and about a quarter of coordinators don't take it up. So the question I wanted to ask in this study was, do coordinators' interpersonal and functional activities improve return to work? As I mentioned earlier, coordinators think there are two components that make a coordinator successful in the role, and that's interpersonal skills and managerial skills. So I wanted to look at these two components of the role and the fulfillment of these activities to see what effect they had on return to work. I also wanted to look at whether their effects were seen over time. So we had longitudinal data. This was a great thing to be able to exploit, looking at the impact throughout the duration of the claim process. And we wanted to see whether we observed them over and above other factors, particularly workplace intervention factors like supervisor intervention, coworker, response to injury, those sorts of things. The data for this study were derived from Peter Smith's Victorian Injured Workers Cohort Study. The original survey at the first time point was 869 injured workers. I limited that down to those who responded to a baseline and follow-up survey. I just wanted to make sure that I didn't overpower one section of the survey statistically compared to the other one, so I wasn't more likely to find a result at baseline than follow-up. And to be eligible for the survey, you had to be off work for at least 2 weeks. This is to get out of the employer access period in Victoria and just when everybody gets onto the WorkSafe system. And we limited the injuries to either an upper body musculoskeletal condition, which was the majority of our sample, or a mental health condition. There were two surveys. There are three surveys. I only had the data for two when I conducted this study. There was a baseline at about 4 months post-injury. That's a bit of time after the injury, and you're probably wondering why we started 4 months post-injury. And it was the earliest we could get them. Between getting injured, reporting to the employer, lodging a claim, making a claim decision, giving them an opportunity to opt out, that all added up to about 4 months from the time of injury to the time of survey on average. The follow-up was 6 months after the initial survey. Okay, so the boring stuff about analysis. We used an outcome that we call sustained return to work. So return to work is not an event, it's a process. And the way we want to make sure that someone had actually engaged in the return to work process, still using a dichotomous outcome, was to see if they'd been back at work for at least a month. So not just back at work at the time of interview, but back at work for a consistent period of at least a month. The reason we chose 1 month is there is some clinical data to suggest that the failed attempts to return to work are mostly within the first month of going back to work. It's not great. It's only clinical observations. I haven't seen any statistical analysis to look at when people fail. It does seem to be, based on some of the literature I've seen, within that first month, though, and it is a pretty consistently used outcome. And for the main exposures, we had the two coordinator activities. For interpersonal activities, we looked at the stressfulness of the interaction between the injured worker and the return-to-work coordinator, as rated by the injured worker. And we took those responses, which were on a 5-point Likert scale, from not at all stressful to extremely stressful, dichotomized those and turned them into either a good interaction or a poor interaction. And those were all compared to having no interaction with a return-to-work coordinator. And to measure functional activities, we used return-to-work plans, whether the injured worker had a return-to-work plan. Both of these were measured at the baseline survey, so the outcome was all from that baseline survey. And the analysis was using a multivariable logistic regression, reported as an odds ratio of the 95% confidence interval. Just to summarize how it's going to look here, if it's greater than 1, it means better return to work outcomes, lower than 1, worse, and if it's about 1, then that means it's about the same, or we couldn't differentiate statistically. And we included a number of variables in the regression models. a couple of workplace factors, but we wanted to make sure that they actually affected the relationship between the coordinator activity and the return to work outcome. So we included them all in crude models, adding them one by one to models just testing the association between each exposure and the return to work outcome to see if it affected the relationship by at least 10%. And if it did, it was included in the larger model. If it didn't, we excluded it. And at the end of this, the only things we included were demographics, just because we include demographics anyway. I don't think all of them passed that threshold. Nevertheless, we included them. Injury type, supervisor reaction to injury, and social support. So interestingly, some of the things that didn't make it in were sense of community, co-worker response to injury and social support, physical and mental workplace demands, job autonomy, and recovery expectations. They had no effect on the association, or at least they didn't cross that 10% threshold of affecting the relationship between either coordinator activity and the return to work outcomes.
Tyler,
yes?
Quickly interrupt. When you were measuring the coordinator activities and the stressfulness, you did it at 4 months. Were they giving you an assessment of all the interactions in that 4 months?
Oh, that is a good question. If I remember how the question was phrased, I believe it was plural, so it was supposed to be the entire extent of interactions with the coordinator.
So they could have had some really stressful ones, but it got better over time in that 4 month period.
Yeah, and it could have gotten better after the 4 month period as well. Yep, good question. So just to describe what the sample looked like at each of the survey periods, about 46% of them had returned to work by baseline survey, which was 4 months post-injury. Again, this may sound like a low number, but you have to remember we're dealing with people with a musculoskeletal condition or a mental health condition who have been off work for at least 2 months and are being back at work for at least a month. So that's going to pretty severely limit the number of people who are actually back to work. Same at baseline, about two-thirds of them were back to work at our baseline survey, or back to work again for at least 1 month. When we look at the types of activities that the coordinators performed for their injured workers, we find about 60% had an interaction with their coordinator, and 5 out of 10 of those were good, meaning that 5 out of 6 were good, meaning 1 out of 6 were rated as poor, so high stress. This is actually a surprisingly low number to have 40% of people not have an interaction with their coordinator 4 months into their injury when this is a requirement for employers by SafeWork. Further to that, the majority of those who said they didn't interact with their coordinator, about 28% of the sample, said they had no coordinator. Things don't look much better with return to work plans. Half of them said they had a return to work plan, meaning half of them didn't. This is not the outlier that I thought it would be. We're analyzing the return to work survey now, which looks all around Australia, and we're finding similar numbers. About half the people interviewed don't have return to work plans. And now to look at the association between coordinator activities and return to work outcomes. These are the crude associations, so we're only looking at the relationship between the coordinator activity and the return to work outcome, not adjusting for anything else. And what we find is that both time points, good interactions and return to work plans, improve the likelihood, or at least are associated with a better likelihood of achieving return to work. Poor interactions are not statistically different from having no interaction with a coordinator. Things change a bit when we start adjusting for the factors that I mentioned in the analysis section. So when we look at baseline, we find only one factor remains significant, that's return to work plans. They double the odds of returning to work by baseline, again, 4 months post-injury. Things flip at follow-up, where now good interactions double the odds of return to work, but return to work plans, you can see that they're about one, so it looks like they don't have any effect when you start adjusting statistically for some confounders. So just again to go through this, both of them were significantly predictive in unadjusted analyses, but when we start adjusting for these confounders, we find that only one is significant at either time point, and at baseline that's return to work plans, and at follow-up that's having a good interaction with your coordinator. So to me, this says that coordinators are effective in achieving return to work, but it's partly dependent on the performance of some activities and dependent on the time that an injured person is returning to work. I think this is the result of having two different types of claims, a short duration and a long duration, or sometimes also called a complex claim. And there's a bit of existing research to suggest that injury-related factors are only important for about the first month of an injury. And after that, psychosocial factors begin to increase in importance. So what I think happened here is that the people were, who were returning to work just about before 4 months in the first survey may have had some functional needs and probably just had a, needed a little bit of a catalyst to get them back to work. I reckon they were probably going to do fine and get back to work in most cases anyway. But it's the people who are returning between 4 months and 10 months that needed a bit of psychosocial support. And having a good interaction with their coordinator may help mitigate some psychosocial factors that may emerge between the injured worker and the workplace. It may prevent some of these. It's hard to say from this research, but it does look like they may have an impact on the psychosocial factors that start to rear up in the later part of a claim. So as I mentioned, I think the activities of the workplace-based coordinators do improve return-to-work outcomes, and I think this could be used to inform the way coordinators target injured workers. I think if we're able to get a good idea of what the trajectory of an injured worker is going to be, an injured worker could, a coordinator could dedicate their resources and their efforts based on that likely trajectory. So again, if someone looks like they're going to return pretty quickly, just make sure they have a return to work plan. If they're going to take longer, make sure that the interactions they have with them are low stress. And based on the adherence to providing a return to work order, and also make sure that someone has a coordinator. I think there are a couple of things we can do to improve coordinators as they are. First, if we revise coordinator training to include interpersonal skills training. There's a bit of research from Australian coordinators from all around the country, and they all seem to say the same thing about training, that it focuses far too much on legislative requirements, and it doesn't really impart skills that would be valuable for being a coordinator. So I think if we did add something like counseling skills to the return to work coordinator training, we may improve some of the return to work coordinator impacts on return to work. And we may also shrink that 1 in 6 rate for stressful or poor interactions. But in some cases, interpersonal skills may be generally immutable. People may be who they are. They may not be terribly empathetic. It may be very hard to impart those skills on someone. Or you may only be able to do just a little bit in increasing someone's agreeableness and empathy. So I think another way we can approach this is to revise coordinator selection criteria. Again, in Victoria, we only have two criteria, and that's competence in return to work and seniority within the organization. But I think if we added another criteria, which was to consider personality traits, we may see further benefits from the return to work coordinator. What was surprising, but it's becoming less surprising the more I speak to people and present these findings and look at other data from around the country, is the high degree of noncompliance for obligations on the part of the employer. Again, half had no return to work plan by 4 months post-injury. Again, you're required to have a plan either when you receive the certificate of capacity or a claim for a wage replacement. And 2 in 5 said they didn't have any interactions with their coordinator. A quarter said they had no coordinator 4 months in. This may be in some cases that people don't recognize their coordinator, that their employee is providing those services. This seems to be the case in smaller organizations, based on some other research conducted in Victoria. And so they may still be getting those services. But even in that case, the people who know they have a coordinator are performing better in return to work than those who don't know they have a coordinator and are still receiving those services. The study I think it does have some pretty good strengths. The first is that we have some prospective outcomes, and we measured the main exposure at baseline. One of the outcomes was also measured at baseline, so it was only cross-sectional, only association, difficult to tease out causality there. But looking at return to work at follow-up, that does give us a temporal relationship between the exposure and the outcome, and it doesn't prove causality because there's no proof in science, but it does give us a better indication that there was a causal relationship between these two. It doesn't rule out a common cause, however. Further, we also use a stable return to work outcome. The people we were looking at who were back at work were probably going to stay back at work, and I think that's a pretty good outcome to use in these types of studies. But it does have some limitations. This is obviously a survey with problems of recall bias. We may have issues of allocation bias where people are given services based on their trajectory. The employer says, well, that guy's probably going to get back. Let's give him a coordinator. Let's make sure they get a plan. That may be an issue with this study. And it's not an exhaustive list of what coordinators do. Again, the name coordinator is coordinate across stakeholders. We didn't look at that, and I think it'd be really valuable to look at coordinator interactions with the healthcare provider to see if they're getting the information they need to develop the return to work plans based on the injured worker's abilities. And the survey, as I noted, does start somewhat late in the process. It's about 4 months post-injury, so we may be missing some things that are occurring early on that may have an effect later on in this the process. And we're dealing with quite a specific coordinator type, an employer-based member of the organization who, and also a specific type of injured worker, someone who's been off for at least 2 weeks with a specific type of injury, either an upper body musculoskeletal or a mental health condition. And therefore, these results may not generalize to hospital-based coordinators or dealing with people who have fractures. So there are still some limits into as to where this may apply. Again, I thank you for your attention. There's the citation for the version of this study that is at the Journal of Occupational Rehabilitation. There is a free link to the study. Unfortunately, you can't print or save it, I'm afraid to say. If you do email me, the email's listed there. I'm happy to send you a PDF of that study. So thank you.
Thank you, Tyler. Thank you, Tyler. That was excellent. Now, I've been encouraged to hand around the microphone or encourage you to come up to the microphone for questions. I wondered if anybody wants to kick us off with the discussion. See if that's on.
Short enough for me. I just had a question about validating the return to work plans. So you've asked via a survey whether or not they've had a plan. Did you do any validating of that against the system to actually understand whether it's an engagement issue, so whether there's actually a plan in place but they've not been adequately engaged with to understand their plan? Because I'd be really amazed if the agent result was 50%. We would fail our KPIs. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really good question. So the answer, unfortunately, is no. The way we address that question, though, is to suggest that if someone has a plan but it doesn't occur to them when we ask them if they have a plan, then it's probably not doing its job anyway. And I should admit that with the return to work survey, it's about half with a formal written plan and about maybe 20%, 30% about there who say they have an informal plan. I think we should be sticking with the formal written plan. And I think my results do suggest that you really do need that formal written plan, something that the injured worker, when they're asked, they say, yeah, of course I got a return to work plan. It's a great question, though. Yeah.
Yeah, I think what we find is that they do have a plan.
Yeah.
Which I think signals that breakdown in communication. So.
Yeah, and that'd be a great study for another study on return to work coordinators. Are they actually coordinating across stakeholders? Yeah.
Yeah, it certainly looked like a very low percentage, and your statistic that having a return to work plan doubles the likelihood of return to work.
Doubles the odds.
Doubles the odds, yeah. Sounds like a good investment. But did your paper go into the cost-benefit and trade-off, Tyler? I mean, because the percentage of people without a plan looked surprisingly low. As you say, you thought it was going to be an outlier, but it was a key result.
Yeah. That's a great question. No, we haven't done any cost-benefit analysis. And just when it comes to odds versus likelihood, because the return-to-work outcome was so common, when you're dealing with odds, it does exaggerate when it says twice the odds, it's probably about 20% increase in likelihood just because of the way that a logistic regression puts out its results. But in terms of doing a cost-benefit analysis, it's really hard to say. I don't know where I'd start with the costs myself. And because we're only looking at two time points, it's really difficult, at least with this survey, to determine when people are getting back and get an assessment of the cost saved from having people back and doing an accurate benefit analysis of when people get back.
Thanks for that, Tyler. Do you have any information or analysis to suggest that there may be KPIs embedded in the return to work coordinator's role that may be influencing the result?
Oh, that's a great question. Again, so this was only looking at injured worker responses, so I haven't looked at the KPIs of return to work coordinators in any depth. Yeah. If you had a follow-up on that. Unfortunately, my contract with this organization ends pretty quickly, so I won't be able to do any more analysis. There is someone out of the University of Newcastle who's doing some really interesting, good work on return-to-work coordinators. That's Joanna Bohatko-Naismith. I cited her a few times in this. Let me see how many times. Twice, but I know she has three papers looking at return-to-work coordinators, the training, what they think is necessary to make a good coordinator. She may have something coming out. Unfortunately, I don't.
Any other questions for Tyler before I jump in with another one?
Yeah, go for it.
I've just come from presenting a paper on mental health. Colleagues put it together. My young colleague spent a lot of time with psychiatrists and psychologists asking the question of what would make a difference. Training was key, and you've touched on that here. The question is whether you saw any substantial differences in outcomes between the mental health group and the musculoskeletal group, and whether your paper touched on any differences between the two groups, Tyler?
That's a great question. So what we did was adjust for injury type. And the most I can say from that, not having separated them into two groups to analyze the impact, is that mental health claimants with a mental health condition had far worse return-to-work outcomes than those with an upper body musculoskeletal. I forget what the odds ratio was. It may have been as high as 2.5 or 3. A future bit of analysis, which would be good with a larger survey sample, would be to look at mental health conditions versus other types of injuries. Unfortunately, considering we only had 20% in this survey, it just doesn't give us the statistical power to be able to do a fully adjusted multivariable logistic regression analysis. We really need quite a few more cases to be able to determine that, separating them as a subgroup and looking at the factors that influence the impact of return-to-work coordinators.
Okay. Tyler, thank you. Look, one of the profound things that came out was the number of people without a plan, or people who were answering the question that they didn't have one. Part of that might be an ambiguity about whether I even know whether there's a plan or even know there's a coordinator, but just wonder if there's anyone else in the audience who wants to reflect on that and what they think the drivers of that outcome might be. Is it resource? Is it training of the people? Or is it understanding of claimants about the support they should or could have access to? Any input from the floor? I'll get my steps on.
My name's Jo, I'm from the TAC, and we've just been running some trials where we did some client surveys on some new interventions in return to work. And so some of the things when we asked them about a plan after the visits, because we've been doing testing mobile case management approaches, is that they said to us that it just gets lost in the sea of correspondence and paperwork. So they don't, because at the moment it just looks like another letter. Or it might have a table in it with goals and things like that, but they're still not necessarily seeing it as their plan, as my own plan. They're sort of talking about, well, that's, you know, the treater's plan for me. It's not my plan. So we just think there's a bit of work to do in how you make it truly client-centric.
That's a really good point. And if we look back at this document here, when it describes coming up with a return to work plan, the first thing is to speak to the injured person themselves. So it's a requirement, or at least it's heavily suggested that they should be developing these plans with the injured person themselves, rather than, as you say, sometimes they just get a plan bestowed upon them that they have no real investment in.
At the last session, one of the claims practitioners encouraged the actuaries in the room to sit in on a few calls to learn a little bit more about what this means in practice, and that sounds like great advice, and I think that input there is really valuable. You know, if people invest themselves and they feel they've given something, and they're more likely to follow through. I imagine there's a huge amount of correspondence and things get lost even for those that are reaching out for help. Other questions?
Tal, I just have one more about you. You talked a little bit about the recruitment of coordinators and perhaps not only on competency and their seniority, but personality traits. Can you just expand a little bit on what you were thinking around personality traits?
There's a lot of junk science in determining personality types. So I am purposefully vague because it's not something I understand very well. But I think possibly if you start administering good quality evidence-based surveys on the way people would react to certain situations as a return to work coordinator, you may be able to tease out the people who have the best disposition to be able to deal with this, because it can be quite stressful speaking across many different stakeholders in the process. As for smaller organizations, that's going to be quite difficult when you don't really have a lot of people to select from. And that's why I think training is still going to be important. I don't know whether training or selection are going to give us better results for return to work coordinators and interpersonal skills. That's why I think both should be, or at least explored.
We're sort of looking at doing a bit of a trial about matching, so actually getting the person to actually identify the sorts of people that they would like to work with and then trying to find that with the coordinator, so you're putting a bit of control the hands of the person.
That's fascinating. And where is that?
I come from iCare for Lifetime Care Support. Yeah.
Thanks, that's really interesting.
Fantastic. I think the science is well-founded around if there's a platform of trust, we get better outcomes, more openness and honesty in the conversation. Any other questions for Tyler? Observations around that aspect? Tyler, I wanted you to go to one of your other slides. You had some of the other categories of the data you captured. There was something in there about the mental demands of the workforce.
Yes, that's right.
Just wondering if you could tell us how much is in the paper around that and how well it's defined from your perspective as a scientist.
Oh, that's a good question. So that was from a validated scale. I can't remember where it came from precisely. It was a three-item Likert scale. What we did was we summed it and divided into tertiles. So we had three groups based on scores and value. Same with physical work demands and job autonomy. As for its validity, it's not something I've worked with quite a bit. It was in the data that I had. Not something I explored in any great depth. I was quite surprised that neither of these factors had any effect on the association between coordinator activities and return to work outcomes, though. I would have imagined that a more stressful job may have made it more difficult for a coordinator to work with an injured worker. So I was quite surprised that it didn't come out as something to include in the final model.
Cool. So let me just check that I'm understanding that. I think you're saying that the coordinator didn't have any impact on that, even if that may have had an impact in and of itself?
Yeah, that's right. So the way I evaluated it is to have a main exposure with an outcome model. And the way you do that is you pair those two and see what that association is. And then you tease each variable in and out of that model just to see if it has an effect. And mental workplace demands may still have a big impact on return to work outcomes. I'm fairly certain they do. but they didn't affect that particular relationship between return to work coordinator activities and return to work outcomes.
Thank you. In the paper we presented, we challenged the actuaries in the room at least to think about what employers can be doing to create better workplaces. There's huge safeguards around physical injury. Truck drivers have clear monitoring of the shifts and what have you, but there's very little in respect of the workplace. So we'll have a look at that and how they're defining those metrics and whether there's some science or some learnings to take away from that. So thank you for that. Other questions for Tyler? How long did the project take, Tyler, and where would you go next if you were still on the payroll?
Where would I go next? So the project, the data was collected before I joined, and I've been working with this since about January 2016. I've been looking at other stakeholders, so I do have another paper coming from this, and that's looking at the impact of healthcare providers and how healthcare providers impact return to work, not just in terms of treatment, but in terms of other activities they add on to their engagement with the injured worker and how they may affect return to work. Also looking at injury-related factors as mediators. So what I'm trying to tease out is, are they just treating the injured worker, or are they treating them and adding some benefit to return to work?
Fantastic. And I think you're on the program again tomorrow, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Do you want to put a plug in for the audience for your session?
Tomorrow I'm going to be, and this is what I'm actually going to work on when I leave this unit that I'm currently in. It's taking a quasi-experimental study design, so policy change, and looking at the impact of a longitudinal time series. So basically, what happened when South Australia and Tasmania started giving money or penalizing employers to report injuries more quickly? Did it actually reduce the time in the claim lodgement process, or did it have no effect, or did it have some unforeseen consequences? I'll let you come to it and see. Try and give it away.
Well, I'd like you all to put your hands together, please, and thank Tyler for his time today.
Thank you very much.
Tyler, this is a small token of the Institute and audience's appreciation for your time. I'll encourage you all to use the app to give feedback. Look, certainly for me as a presenter, it's great to get your impact. Well, a huge amount of time and effort for all of us goes into this, so please keep your feedback coming. It's much appreciated. Enjoy your morning tea, your afternoon tea, and see you later on.